Shelly Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelly.
14th day of April 2022, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this is indeed the show you were looking for. How do I know that? Because you're hearing me say this. Anyway, it's Thursday. It is the second to last broadcast day of the week of the O'Shelly Effect. So here we are, live and all that good stuff. Now, normally I have Michael Swanson with me, the guy behind WallStreetWindow.com, in the first hour, but he's away. And I think we discussed that last week. And we're going to have a lot to discuss with Mike when he comes back from his trip because, the inflationary curve is doing nothing but squashing us all and grabbing us by the Balzac, yeah? All right. Mike will have something to say about that. But there's a lot of other things in the news. And I've gotten a couple of articles together from J.P. Satilli's Rundown and a few other places. Want to talk about some of the stuff that's just happening also in general. And who knows, maybe I won't discuss the Ukrainian war at the moment. Okay. So, that's right, I forgot. Phone lines are open, 319-527-5016. That is 319-527-5016. Now, I don't speak as quickly as Johnny Vedmore does, but man, that guy was quick. If you didn't hear that from last night on the Wednesday show, I can't speak as quickly as Johnny. But look, I am from the Northeast and all that good stuff. I'm sure you can tell I'm not a native of Macon, Georgia, where I'm sitting, but I do live here, baby. Anyways, speaking of places where I used to live, how about New York City and what's going on with the Brooklyn shooter situation? Interesting how all this has gone. Very, very fast arraignment, in my opinion, because usually you wind up sitting around a bit. And I got to tell you, anything you guys want to bring up, by the way, when you call in, I will absolutely stop the show and give the caller priority like I do on Friday nights. But anyway, very fast arraignment. He got in there this morning, apparently did not put in a plea, according to reports. I don't know what the deal is. I mean, you're talking about a guy who gave a tip up on himself to the tip line. Some kid who was a high school photographer, you know, kind of reminds me of Scott Enyard, who was on Donald Jeffrey's show just the other day, and who I've interviewed before. High school photographer, just happened to capture him on a bench sitting somewhere, and supposedly calls in from McDonald's and gives himself up on a tip line. So there's that. There's the racial epithets and all that good stuff that he was posting online. I mean, you know, how much weirder does that story have to get? The other devices that are allegedly there, that were alleged to have been there, the smoke bomb, and we got the initial reports, the cam videos from the phones, right? The phone cameras, as per usual, you know, capturing some of what was going on. Bit of chaos and confusion. I mean, the initial reports, the first witness I heard from, just in general, said that he thought it was a bunch of fireworks. I mean, it's a crazy situation. You know, apparently he's talking about blacks and crime and this and that on these social media posts, as I mentioned before. But I mean, man, really, really weird. And again, no plea entered. Federal terrorism charges possible. All this kind of, you know, our good friends at Homeland Security definitely going to get involved in the equation here, huh? But is he a terrorist or is he just a nut? Do they use people like this to cause certain situations? Are there some random possibilities here? I don't even want to utter the guy's name. Screw him. Not going to do it. Okay? So, you know, there's that. There's Elon Musk trying to buy Twitter. Yawn, except I guarantee there's going to be some sort of financial malfeasance here because that guy keeps getting to skate on trying to manipulate stocks and stuff. And if he's going to play this game and offer billions and billions of dollars, you know, like Carl Sagan used to say, billions and billions, right? It was Carl Sagan, wasn't it? I don't know. Maybe I'm suffering the Mandela effect. Anyways, a lot of stuff going on there. Elon Musk wanted to buy Twitter, like I said. Oh, Bill Maher's stupid stand-up special. You know, he's not funny anymore. And if people didn't realize that about 10 years ago, don't know what to tell you. I guess HBO still keeps paying him because, yeah, you can get paid at HBO for not actually being a talent sometimes. All right. All that is going on, and like I said, I got a couple of stories lined up, but it does also look like I got a caller lined up. So, oh, I know who this is. I'm going to take the call. And, you know, last time this guy called in, it went really strange. Who knows what will happen this time? Jimmy James. Have you been suffering the Mandela effect, my brother? How are you?
Yes, all day, every day. It seems like Mangala effect all day.
Are you still with the Mangala effect, right?
Oh, Mandela effect. Sorry.
Oh, Mandela. No, no, it's okay. Look, Mangala is another thing where there are some people that claim that he was captured and exposed in public in a certain way, and then other people claim that he disappeared, never to reemerge again. Right? Mangala, and we know who he's supposed to be.
I could have sworn I seen him taken to Israel.
Okay, see, now there's another there is a Mangala thing that goes on. It's not as popular as the you know, as the Mandela deal. Not at all, but another one of those alternate multiverse reality theories out there, which, by the way, I don't know if I made it clear, but I just figure that this is a function of memory, where memory is not a recording device. I really do feel that way personally, but it is funny when you experience these things and you could swear up and down that you saw something or you heard something and you've always repeated it and it's always been and not necessarily true. It should tell you about what it really means when you're listening to eyewitness testimony. Not saying you can't rely on it at all, but don't take it as absolute gospel. Every detail can be revised over time. That's my true view on the Mandela effect, but anyway, we did explore that, though, the last time you called in. What you got for me today, Jimmy James?
Well, remember now the day before this guy that went nuts in New York, and a totally, completely unrelated thing, I guess. Everyone was going nutso in Times Square because there was an explosion, they said. How come everyone was so jumpy the day before this bizarre thing?
Well, you mean that they were jumpy in Times Square because of the explosion, or were they jumpy when they went on the train in Brooklyn? I mean, Brooklyn's a little far away from Times Square, generally speaking. I mean, it doesn't... Yeah.
The day before any of this happened, I was getting all kinds of red alerts in my email saying there's been an explosion in Times Square. And then later on, they said, everyone's running, they're panicking. Huh. And then, like, a couple hours later, they said, it's just a gas pocket blew up in the sewer. Don't worry about it.
Well, oddly enough, I mean, okay. I'll tell you that, objectively, I know that weird things like that happen in New York City, where all of a sudden something happens. You know, you have like, a gas leak or something underground, and manhole covers start to fire up, and you hear booms and weird stuff. This does occur from time to time in New York City, right? I didn't know about the details of that, though. It is strange how that kind of happened and then disappeared as a story, because you'd figure somebody might want to improve the situation or change whatever it is that causes that crap, but they never do. It's just like, something that happens, you know? It's like when you do run into the giant rats in New York City. Nobody ever figures out a way to get rid of them. It's just kind of like, yeah, just steer clear of that thing, and we'll move on with our day. I don't understand. I mean, and I lived in New York for a little while. I'm mainly from New Jersey, but I mean, I lived in New York City, and it is a weird thing to witness, where it's sort of like, you know, just the attitudes. I don't want to do the typical New York bashing thing, but I mean, the idea that somebody gets, you know, knifed to death or shot to death when I was a kid in New York and the bodies lay in there, there would be people pissed that, you know, like, you're making me late now. Yeah, the guy's dead already. You're making me late. Move. Okay. Like, this used to be the thing. But the stuff that they accept in general is very, very weird. Like I talked about the Tompkins Square riots on one show. Go ahead, Jimmy. Sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, like, when I was a kid, yeah, that's why I used to have a lot of respect for New Yorkers. I was like, I like New Yorkers. They're tough. But then Mayor Doomberg got in there, and then all I hear is, oh, smoking's banned in New York. Oh, you're only allowed to have 6-ounce Slurpees. Mm. I was like, what is wrong with these people?
You know, I don't know. There has been a lot of strangeness in New York City where there is a toughness to the general public, but when it comes to political figures, it swings wildly between the snowflake of snowflakes among the liberals and the most, like, oppressive right-wing jacksticks you ever seen. And I could never figure it out. It was like... It never makes any sense to me who it is they put in charge of stuff, but it's like, let's go one extreme. Let's go back the other direction. Let's go, like, you know, Giuliani supposedly concerned about all the pornography, right? like pornography is the problem in New York City. No. Okay, that was not the issue. And even these guys who, you know, go in and try and do it, it's like the whole battle over needle exchanges. And this does take me right again to the Tompkins Square riot, where that's what they call it. But the fact is that the news media didn't want to cover it. And if somebody didn't have a camcorder or a couple of people didn't have camcorders in the middle of that mess, I don't think anybody in the world would have ever heard about it. And what the cops basically did is sort of herd homeless people into Tompkins Square Park. From a wide area of Manhattan into Tompkins Square Park, and then they proceeded to just, like, start beating down on them. Just, like, beating the crap. I'm thinking to myself, you know, look, no matter how you stand on the homeless issue in New York, how is that going to solve anything? And it was people from the neighborhood, which I was only... You know, I'm saying, people from the neighborhood, which I was only on East 9th Street at that time. I was on East 9th between 1st and A. Okay, which means I could throw a stone into Tompkins Square Park from my stoop, right? People from the neighborhood came out and confronted the cops. Stop. Stop this. And they were not in black uniforms back then. They were still in blue. And they didn't have a lot of equipment, but they all had nightsticks. And I assure you those hurt. Because they started taking swings at us. I wound up cuffed to a... I'm sure you heard me tell this story. I wound up cuffed to the wrought iron fence on the one side of the park. Because we confronted the cops. Knock this off. What are you doing? And nobody would have ever heard
about it. Unlike those characters that let that black guy, the three cops, lay on the black guy for 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of filming it, honestly, I'd have been, get the hell off that man. Are you nuts?
Well, see, now there is the problem, though, is that as the escalation of... See, this always gets me in trouble, but here we go. Okay, now I'm going to get all kinds of, you're a liberal. Okay, whatever. Police have gotten more emboldened over the past couple of decades. You know, when I'm talking about Tompkins Square, I'm talking about the 90s. When you look at it today, I mean, they're ready to pull their guns on you, or they do pull their guns on you for not understanding a command. Okay, when they're saying, you know, do this, and you don't know, what did you say? The gun comes out. You know what I mean? They are way more tense than they used to be. You know, and trying to confront them when they're in the middle of doing something is definitely putting your life in. I mean, I got beat up a little, but, you know, nowadays I would expect to get shot if I tried to stand between them in an action like that. I wasn't alone, which was good, which is another thing. You know, people get a little more bold when they're in a group, right? So that did help. I mean, it's not like I was, you know, Mr. Courageous Cat. I was just following the group, and quite honestly, I thought the group was doing the right thing, so I stood in the way. But the cops would chase people up on top of cars and all kinds of... And like I said, if nobody had videotape that they, you know, somehow got to the TV stations in New York... Nobody would have ever seen any of this. Today, you got people filming everything.
So some news guy did get footage of that, huh?
Yeah, like the next day.
You're lucky there, because otherwise they could have just charged. I don't know what you're talking about. A bunch of crazy homeless people were attacking us.
Yeah, right. If there wasn't videotape, see, that's the thing, is that basically NYPD, if you go look at the history of the Tompkins Square riot, the NYPD said that nothing happened. They had dozens of officers down there. They had guys on horseback around the park. The horse units in New York. You've seen them on TV and stuff, right?
Oh yeah.
Okay, so they had those guys around the park. They had some cars there, but mostly what I saw from where I was guys on foot, there was dozens of them, and just swinging away with the billy clubs. It was just like, and these homeless guys were not armed. Nobody was armed that I saw. I didn't see knives. I mean, I don't know. Maybe there were. I don't know if there were any weapons, because I never saw any, and I didn't have one on me. But they just whacked anybody who got in the way. And like I said, I cuffed at a fence there. I don't know what would have happened to me if I didn't, a particular reporter didn't come by and cut me loose, who worked for the New York Post and convinced the cop to unlock me. But it was just because I was a friend of his that I got out of there. I don't even know what would have happened to me. I would have probably gone in, I don't know, 9th precinct or 10th precinct. And, you go in those holding cells, it's not fun. But anyway, so I don't know what would happen. And if that tape had not gone out to the news, the NYPD was basically saying nothing happened. But it wasn't nothing. I mean, I don't know how you want to report it or explain it, or if they were going to say, oh, homeless people attack cops, so we called backup. I don't know what they were going to say. But everybody knew about this. I caught it a little late, but they were like, they've been doing this now for some people said it was for days, and other people said they were doing it all day. And then when nightfall came and everybody was in there, that's when it went off. That's what it was like, and all the homeless people in the park kind of deterred a lot of other people from walking through there or anything. So it was just the homeless people and the cops. And then when they started doing this, like I said, people came out because they saw from their windows what was going on around the park. And they just came outside, and I was one of them who was kind of alerted to it and went down there, like I said, about half a block away.
So the homeless people were the one policing the perimeter, saying, nah, you don't want to go in there, man. We're having a battle.
No, they were just in the park. What I'm saying is that like your regular pedestrians were avoiding it because it was like big clump of homeless people.
I thought you meant like the homeless were actually like saying, no, you can't go in here. Right now we're battling with the police.
Okay, what the idea is that the cops were kind of making these guys move on, go down that way, and they sort of pushed them, bunches of them, into the park. Like, go in the park. Go sleep on a bench in the park. Get off the street over here. Don't be by this guy's stoop. Don't be on the church steps. Get out of here, right? And they pushed them toward the park. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And then when night came, then they just started beating the crap out of them. I don't know what went on in between, but they pushed them into the park and started beating the crap out of them. I mean, I tend to think there was some strategic move going on there, but there's been no documentation about it or anything like that that ever came out, except the media exposed that it happened. So, the cops, I forget what the excuse was finally, but they couldn't just say, like you said, we had police attacked by homeless people, which would have been very strange, because most homeless people in New York, they try and avoid the cops altogether, because they don't want to be hassled. I mean, common sense, right?
Right.
Okay, so
normal homeless people don't like to engage with pretty much anyone.
Mostly, no. You're just trying to kind of stay out of the way, kind of stay hidden, find a place to sleep, okay? That's it. But, that went on. If you look it up, it's a pretty crazy situation. And there's, like, little bits of video. Not much, because one of the guys with the camcorder, which is not a homeless guy, the cops surrounded a car. The guy ran on top of a car to try and get away from the cops. And they surrounded the car and were swinging at him and banging him in the knees and everything else while he was videotaping. That was one of two videotapes I remember that they played on the news.
Oh, he was videotaping? Was that a camera?
Yeah, he had a camera. It wasn't a homeless guy. It was a guy from the neighborhood ran outside with a camcorder, like, you know, one of those old ones with the, like, you know, either a VHS or a VHS-C tape in it. Yeah. Well, it's the 90s, yeah. Dude. There's no digital, you know. I mean, this is what they had. So the guy went down to document it. Yeah, sorry.
The cojones on these cops.
Well, but that's the thing. If they had gotten the camcorder away from the guy and broke it, that probably would have been the end of it. You know what I mean? Like, nobody would have ever seen it. I don't know how the tape got out. I recall one guy said something about having to give the tape to somebody else to, like, escape the park with it. But, you know, and they wound up taking the one guy's camera. I don't know what happened to the guy on top of the car. But I distinctly remember the footage of them, like, swinging and jumping at him because he was a little too high. It was a higher vehicle, I guess. So, you know, not every cop in New York is 6'6" or 6'5", you know what I mean? So they were, like, jumping up at him and swinging batons from, like, every direction and trying to knock him off the car. So I don't know how his videotape ever got out, but the other guy I know, there was a story about him handing it off to somebody. And they smashed his camera in the meantime, but the tape got out, you see. So I don't know, you know. And I didn't see anybody videotape. I was just involved with the crowd of people going, hey, knock that off. Okay. What are you doing? You know, why are you beating up on these guys? Like, yeah. But today, I don't know if I would be so inclined because I would figure that I would get shot, whether I have a weapon or not. Which, oh, by the way, in Georgia now, we have it. Yeah.
Or at the very least, tasered, which would be just as dangerous, really.
No, fair enough. But see, back then, the cops in New York really weren't equipped like that. They had a billy club, a gun, a flashlight, cuffs. You know what I mean? These are guys with blue shirts on. All right?
Yeah. So this is kind of like back when they were still packing 38 special revolver, old wheel guns and junk like that.
Well, I'm pretty sure a lot of those cops, were the older ones especially, I guarantee had revolvers. You know what I mean? They were not equipped the same way they are today. I mean, today they're wearing flak jackets and, you know, they got taser and, you know, I mean, they might have had mace, I think. But I think some of them had mace, but they weren't using it that night in the park. They were just beating on people with the sticks. At least that's what I saw. I don't know. Maybe some people got mace too. But generally speaking, you only saw, you know, cuffs, stick, gun, on the belt. That was it, you know? Like I said, today, a lot of other stuff, right? And taser is one of those things that I don't think a lot of people had. I'm sure they were already around, but I don't think they were super popular in law enforcement circles yet. I could be wrong about that, but I never saw them much.
I don't think they're particularly popular today amongst them. They say, come on, we just want to use the real guns.
Well, I don't know. I, you know, look, I can't say that I know for sure, but it does seem to me like a lot more of them are equipped with tasers nowadays than they were, say, 10, 15, 20 years ago.
I think a lot of that's because the municipality said, well, here, we're going to give you a non-lethal option. You know, I guess this will be better than blowing the guy away. I don't know. Give him a taser gun.
Well, you know, look, anything that where somebody doesn't have to get killed in an interaction with the police, I'm for, you know, but they got to use it right and at the right time. But nevertheless, I mean, and trust me when I tell you, those flashlights hurt worse than the sticks. those things are ridiculous. Those long mag lights they used to have. I don't even know if they carry those. I don't think they carry those anymore. What?
I said, oh, yeah, I got one of them laying around. I like those big flashlights.
Yeah, I got hit.
No, they make little.
Yeah.
They got little teeny tiny flashlights, even more powerful now, so they don't really got an excuse to carry that big heavy thing.
Yeah, now they have these things that are like in the palm of their hand that are like, you know, like brighter, like you said, than even those mag lights. But I'm sure somewhere somebody still got them out there, cops wise anyway. I don't even know too many people that have them anymore. But I remember the big advertising point was they were made from, what was it, aircraft-grade aluminum, right? It wasn't the aluminum I cared about. It was the damn batteries that hurt. You know, those things hurt. You get hit with 6 or 8, you know, D batteries. I don't care what you put it in. That's going to hurt. You know, you put them in a pillowcase. That sucks. Right?
For sure.
Okay. I don't even know why I'm doing this with you, but okay. So, but you're right about one thing, and that is that, you know, it changes how it is that you can confront these people anymore, because now it's a greater risk of getting shot, in my mind. You know, like I said, if that situation had occurred today, as it did in the 90s, I don't know if I would have put my body in between. You know, I kind of had a weird expectation back then that the police might not shoot me. Unless I had a weapon, at least, which I did not have. I made sure not to have a weapon when going anywhere near police, because that was a good way to get shot, I thought. But back then, you know, I had this odd expectation. It's changed over the years because of my interactions and what's gone on and what I see generally. I would say that it's probably a safer bet that I'd get shot in an interaction than not. So, you know, again, that's just the way I see it. But what else you got on your mind, Jimmy James? Anything else?
Well, you're going to be talking to Professor Hancock, right?
Yes, sir. I am going to do that in the next hour. I just didn't have Mike this week, so I figured I'll open the lines and maybe do a little news brief. But other than that, I mean, I didn't actually have a plan for today. Because I got Larry, and Larry's got a very interesting topic to discuss, so I'm going to let him introduce it and everything in the second hour, and it's not going to be Ukraine, spoiler alert, but then again,
is it JFK?
No, it is not JFK either.
Wow. Oh.
Don't worry, there's lots of JFK stuff coming up. I have a pile of authors that I should have gotten to already that I have not gotten to, people that I've not had on the show before. And I'm also going to get back to Michael Marcades and talk a little more Rose Sheremy with him very soon. It's just I've been backed up with other things going on. And, you know, my war with the hackers going on as, you know.
Still?
Oh, well, no. It's finally under control, but that cost me money and time, and that took over 40 days to resolve. Yeah. So, and it really actually made me broke, which, by the way, I want to give a big shout-out to, well, first, you know what, to you for making a contribution, but also to our friend Ed out in Washington, because he sent me something very cool. Along with a birthday wish and a few other things. I don't know, maybe I'll discuss that on a later show, what he actually sent, along with, he always sends something for Kim, too, when he does that. But, I just want to say, like, I'd be so screwed up right now if it wasn't for you guys, and also my friend Nature Boy keeping me afloat here and keeping me organized and rolling. Like, last night's whole show was something that he put together. And I thought that was great, by the way. But who knows? Maybe I'll get some hate mail about it. It hasn't been out that long. So the podcast always generates the best hate mail. So we'll see what happens there. But Johnny Vedmore was pretty good. Did you hear that segment?
Oh, yeah, I heard the whole show. Yeah, first guess. I heard the whole show yesterday, yep.
Oh, cool. Interesting when you hear a guy who can talk way faster than me on the show, isn't it?
Yeah, some people, like, once I tried to listen to that one guy, Ben Shapiro, I think his name is.
Okay.
Is that his name?
Yeah.
Or whatever his name is.
Yeah,
he talks
Ben Shapiro.
So fast that for the first time in my life, I was like, I'm going to slow this guy's voice down. So I went to the thing and it's like, play it. 0.5. I was like, oh, there, he's talking normal.
Yeah, like half speed. You got to bring him down. I don't know. Some people complain to me, like, you know, when I give out the phone number especially or whatever. I couldn't understand that. I try, you know, and we do speak a little quicker in the northeast of the country, I think, than the rest of it. But I try to be reasonable, but Bedmore was, like, running circles around me at his speed last night. I was like, I couldn't. There was no way. I was, like, purposely going slower when I broke in on him. Just to, like, let him breathe. I was actually worried he wasn't breathing in between all that. But action-packed.
Oh,
and
he's moving.
Yeah.
He was moving. I mean, you're going to have him back, he said, probably. Probably going to have to, because he
guaranteed,
barely got into his thing, because it's such a long, complicated thing.
Yeah, I mean, he's got a 7,000-word article on, Unlimited Hangout. That is just so full of information, it's impossible to do in an hour. I think what I got to do with him is do a 2-hour show and just say, okay, everybody, here's Johnny Bedmore, and just shut my mic off. I think that's what I got to do next time, and just sit back and just let him roll, you know, until he actually takes a break a little more naturally. I mean, I was trying to break in and say, okay, keep in mind that these are names you should know from this or that, but yikes. I mean, I could barely catch him in the middle of what he was saying. You know, like when he was talking about Galbraith and McGeorge Bundy and stuff like that, which you're familiar with those
names.
Yeah.
So just like you said, well, a lot of people's going to be familiar with McBundy's head. I was like, heck yeah. All kinds of names are ringing bells. And then before I can, he's already on to something else.
Well, that's why I was trying to stop him. Yeah, that's why I was trying to stop him. Like, wait. You know, like, let everybody soak in that, you know, 18 names you just gave him in 15 seconds. And, you know, let me just break down for a second. And, by the way, breathe, dude. But, no, he's pretty interesting. And I definitely want to have him back. So we're going to do that. But, oh, by the way, still, phone lines are open, 319-527-5016. And I do have those articles. If Jimmy James doesn't have anything else he wants to talk about, I'll get to that. If not, doesn't matter, because I got Larry Hancock in the next hour, like I said. I'll be more than happy to entertain anything else you want to cover, Jimmy James. Do you have thoughts about some of the news stories that I started bringing up, by the way, outside of where we went, you know, on this shooter thing? Wild story out of Brooklyn, don't you think?
Very wild.
I mean, very unlikely, but also a strange twist in that the guy calls his own tip in, right?
Yeah, what? He called himself in at McDonald's?
That's what I understand so far, yeah. And even weirder, they got him through the system and got him to a hearing this morning. You know, like, real fast. I don't know about people getting hearings that quick, usually. You know, not for something like this. You know, you get caught peeing outside or something, they give you a hearing by morning if you're lucky. And it's not a weekend. But, you know, in New York, to have somebody get right in there, that's pretty interesting. And also, this kid found him. Which supposedly prompted him to go and turn himself in at the McDonald's. He was sitting on a public bench. And this kid who's like a photographer, like a high school photographer, was like walking around looking for things to take pictures of. And he's like, I think that's the guy. And he took a picture of him. And the guy realizes that people are seeing him and looking for him. And then he just goes, all right, I'll just, and he went to the McDonald's. I mean, this is part of this. I mean, you know, it's a developing story, but from what I understand, that's how that went down, which I find really strange. You know, the guy supposedly said, I forget what part of the Midwest he was in, that he would not be back and that he would not return there alive or something. and all that, like all these really weird rants online about black people, and they've been forced into committing crimes, and now white people are going to get what they get because you know, because they've made it so that black people have to commit crimes. All this weird stuff he was saying. And funny, because I'll tell you, if you or I, Jimmy James, normally, were to go online and make some, like, vaguely terrorist-type statements like this.
Oh, they'd be at our house.
Yeah.
They'd kick down our door.
Generally, that's what would happen. And, of course, there's a Jersey connection to this guy. Duh. Everything weird goes through New Jersey, by the way. Remember that. There's always a Jersey connection. So, I mean, seriously, like at least 70% of the time, if you take a look at one of these national interstate-type stories, like, there's always some New Jersey angle or element in there. I don't know what that means, but it seems to be. Anyway, the guy's...
Was maybe that? It's the northern Florida.
No, it's probably because they contaminated the drinking water so long ago that we're all brain damaged from there. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, we're all just crazy. That's what I think, to be honest with you, because they screwed up the water table like decades ago. Ciba Geigy and all these chemical companies just totally wrecked New Jersey's water. So that's what I think did it. just a theory.
Did you see the old movie Nothing But Trouble that happens in deep in New Jersey?
No, I don't think I've seen that one. That's interesting. Nothing But Trouble.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm not kidding you.
Starring Chevy Chase and Demi Moore.
Well, that was Pennsylvania, if you're talking about the one where they meet the judge.
Yeah, they meet the judge, but I could have sworn it was New York. No, it was New York City, wasn't it?
No, it's not New York. That's...
No, the town had a name similar to, like, Transylvania, but it was in New Jersey, I think.
No, it's Pennsylvania, I think, and it's in Pennsylvania. It's a mining area. Yeah, it's a mining area in Pennsylvania where they mined out everything, and they were trying to bring back the metal. Yeah. No, I know. That's, as a matter of fact, that's a funny thing you bring that up. Tupac Shakur is in that movie for like a quick second, right?
Oh, is he part of the band that they all, where the judge was making them sing for him?
Yeah, he's part of the Digital Underground. I'm not kidding. Tupac Shakur is there playing keyboards. Yeah. He's playing keyboards.
He's part of the movie.
He is.
He made the judge made them sing. I like how they all laughed at him.
Yep.
And then he's like, oh, yeah, that's what. Now sing. And then they sang, and then he just opened up a thing, and they all fell into a pit.
Yep. He's like, okay, prove that you're a band. And it was, what was it, Dan Aykroyd was playing the like, decrepit judge, right?
Yeah.
And John Candy. Okay, so I know that movie. I know that movie, but no, that's Pennsylvania, though. That's not New Jersey. Yeah, that's Pennsylvania. I'm almost positive that is Pennsylvania. Supposed to be. And it's some weird town that like has its own law and everything.
The judge was telling, because the Demi Moore character was a lawyer or whatever, and he's like, you cause of trouble in my shire, this, that, the other thing. She says, what? The stuff you're saying is pre-Magna Carta. And he's like shaking his head, yeah.
Yeah, well, but that's the thing. It's like his domain. Like, they own the whole town. And what was it? They had the one cop. Who was playing the cop? Was it John Candy was the cop? Or was John...
Yeah. He was the cop and his sister.
And his sister, right. Elmira or something. I don't remember what her name was, but it was funny. They were trying to make Chevy Chase marry her or whatever. Yeah, no, it's a crazy movie. But no, when the Digital Underground comes in, you know, the Humpty Hump guy, right? I do the hump to dance. That guy. The Digital Underground is in there, and at that time, Tupac Shakur was in the group, and he's in the movie. Like, for a second, playing a keyboard. And Dan Aykroyd pulls out, like, an organ and starts playing an organ along with the band, right? From the judge's bench. Yeah. No, it's a great movie, though. It is a great movie. It's hilarious. He gives him the sausages, and the sausage is, like, quivering on the plate. Like, why is the sausage quivering? Remember that? And it's like, oh, my God, what is going on in this place? Yep, they took a wrong turn.
What about Dan Aykroyd's
nose? Yeah, and like part of his nose fell off, right? Like during dinner or something. And they put like
his nose looks like a penis.
Yeah, well, there's that, but it fell off. Remember, at one point, I don't know if that was part of it's supposed to happen in the movie. Well, I think when they were sitting around, they were putting like food. Yeah, but they were putting food on that. They were putting food on the train, right? Like there was a train that ran around the house and the table, and there was food on it, and you had to like grab the food from the train as it goes by. And yeah, I think that's when Aykroyd's nose. I haven't seen that movie in years, but it's really hilarious. I mean, it's totally absurd, but it's hilarious, right? That's when Chevy Chase was still funny.
Yeah, that was like the turning point right there. Something in that movie, that must have broke him.
I don't know. Something went wrong after that because he was in that one movie where he's possessed by a demon. I can't remember the name of it. But once he was in that movie, which had a lot of stars in it, because, again, John Candy, Dan Aykroyd, Chevy Chase, Demi Moore. Like I said, Digital Underground, they were stars at the time in the music world. It's pretty star-studded group of people involved in this like crazy absurd comedy, right? So, I don't know.
Yeah, like none of them outside of John Candy, maybe, I could ever see really doing a movie like that. It's like, who was calling the shots? I said, yes, Chevy Chase, yes, Demi Moore, you will be in this movie.
That is a hell of a question. I often wonder stuff when I see like some of these actors, like they do something weird like that, and I go, who in the hell thought that was a good idea for all these people? I mean, like, it's not one guy who maybe owed a favor, you got to do this script because, you know what I mean? Like, okay, listen, if you do this, we're going to put you in the next Star Wars movie. You know what I mean? Or something like that. No, it's a whole bunch of them had to agree to this willingly at some point.
Like a compact.
I mean, you would have expected that this would be the kind of thing that a bunch of no-name actors would have tried to pull off.
Holy crap, I just remembered the two giant babies.
Yeah.
The scrapyard throwing stuff around the giants.
Yeah, one of them, oh, Bumbo, you're just being dumb. Whatever. And they're arguing with each other, and they're like totally filthy and sitting there in diapers. And they're like sumo wrestler sized babies.
Yeah. And they like Demi Moore. They listen to Demi Moore.
Yeah.
Over anyone.
Exactly. They were going to do...
Of course they...
Well, I mean, listen, out of the cast at the time, who was more attractive? I mean, if you're looking at John Candy in a dress all day, I mean, Demi Moore really looks good when she shows up, right?
Man, that's a funny movie. I'm going to have to watch it.
Now you're going to make me have to watch it. Yeah. Go ahead.
I have a question for John Hancock. I'm just curious if you know. Man, this is aggravating. So when they were interrogating Beckham in the 70s, they're talking to him. He says, Yeah, that's right. And we all belonged to this group. There was about 60 of us.
Okay.
And then the idiot doing the questioning says, okay, it's time for lunch. Let's all break for lunch. And that's it. No answers as to what this organization is. Nothing. And I've heard it on tape. The guy doing the questioning never went back to it.
I would have to have the reference in front of me. I don't recall the precise circumstances.
Just tell them it's when the congressional investigators, in fact, I think it was, what's the two good ones that went to Mexico? Lopez and
Hardaway.
It might have been one of them that was questioning him. I mean, it's even on tape. Yeah, the only reason I've heard it's because he's got it on tape, so I know he knows about it.
Yeah, I'll have to go check through my HSCA recordings then, because it's not popping right to the front of my mind as you're talking about it, honestly. But I mean, you got to understand, you know how many hours of tape I've listened to.
Well, sure, and no one, I don't know if the interviewer just was like seriously hungry or dumb or what. But they're sitting there talking about all the people he met with right before the Kennedy assassination.
Right.
And we all belong to this group, you know. And the guys are going, hey, I'm hungry. Let's go to lunch.
Yeah, well, maybe it was something they weren't supposed to talk about, huh?
Oh, there's something that Beckham wanted to talk about, and it's something I want to know. I know that much.
No, look, fair enough. I'm not saying that you and I don't want to know what that is, because Beckham's a weird figure. You know, some people put a lot of stock in him. I got mixed feelings on the guy as to how legitimate he really is. I know Joan Mellon's fairly convinced that he's, completely legitimate, seems like. But, you know, to me, I'm not sure.
I'll be honest, I'm convinced, because every time I doubt the man and go and look, hell, I got pictures and videos of him there. I got people saying he was there. Everyone says he's there. He said he was there. Jack Martin said he was there.
Oh no,
pictures say he was there.
I believe he was there. No. I believe he was there, but I don't know that he knew what he claims to have known. You see, that's a problem with some of these guys who later on, discover new facts and then fill them in when basically they were in the dark while they were doing a lot of things. You know, like Bessiana was in the dark.
Well, that's the thing with Beckham. Beckham never claimed to be squat. I love his tapes. I love his testimony. I listen to him. He's just, he's a courier. He's like, I don't know, Mr. Howard told me or Mr. Whoever told me to go meet with Mr. Howard. They told me to get on the plane. They told me to wear no jewelry, bring no attention to myself.
Right.
He's very humble. He never says anything crazy.
Yeah.
Really.
In official interviews, that's right. But the problem for me comes when other people start interviewing. He starts adding information where I'm like, yeah, I don't know if that's legit. If you stick to the official record... I believe 90% of what he says. But like you said, it's very incomplete and right away. I'm part of this group. Yeah, let's go to lunch. Very incomplete what anybody got on the official record with him. Other authors, though, that went after him later got different stories out of him that I don't know are reliable. I got to be honest, because my gut tells me, and the fact that, yeah, you can back up a whole lot of the stuff he said in the official record, but you can't back up some of the things he told authors later. Now, I'm not saying that you're going to 100% be able to validate things with every story. That's impossible. I mean, I tried that in my own life, trying to back up things that I know are certainly true. And evidence may or may not exist. And I'm nobody special, but I'm just saying general things that I thought would have been preserved or noted in a historical record somewhere that I could line up with certain things. it can't be done in some cases. I mean, it's and the further you go back in history, the harder it is. So I don't know if all of Beckham's stories that he told to people privately or among private researchers or among private authors, I don't know if those things are all accurate, but I do agree with you that his testimony is valid on the official record. And that he certainly was part of something that I think he had no comprehension of. And I think that somebody did consider using him for more things, because it just, it makes no sense to put him in places where he was unless he was maybe going to be useful to somebody later. But outside of that, I don't know what else to make of him. What are your thoughts?
Well, yeah, pretty much what you said. I think that if just Lee Harvey Oswald didn't stick, this could have been the second guy that they nabbed.
See, now, I don't disagree with you. I think that when you take a look at the Patsy profile of, sorry to say, many a terrorist, many a assassin, you often find these interesting people in the universe of activities that look like backup options. And, you know, when you read the assassination guide, which you've read, right?
Oh, yeah, the CIA paper.
Right. It's a beautiful document. You read in there that they tell you to prepare contingency plans like that. So, you know, just going by their own playbook, right? You got to assume that these guys are in play. And I think we've seen that over and over again in many situations, not necessarily linked to the assassination either. Like, I still have some massive questions about Timothy McVeigh and the second guy, or possibly the third guy with McVeigh. You know, and McVeigh keeping his mouth shut as he did, and that's Oklahoma City. But also the 93 World Trade Center bombing has some loose ends like this. And I'm sure they were able to cover it up better. But there's definitely some intelligence assets in play that I think were meant to be used for something in all of these circumstances almost every time. Very weird stuff goes on. Here we go again. Now I'm going to take it back to current events. I don't know what to make of this guy with his explosives and his smoke bomb and shooting stuff on the subway. Very bizarre. In my mind,
very, very bizarre.
You know, and look, people for their own political ends, not necessarily even the government. It's not like people that are political radicals of one type or another might not want to utilize useful idiots too. They do this all the time, and you don't have to be the government to try and run an asset like that. So, I mean, the possibility that somebody is staged or put in place, and look, I'm not going full on, you know, false flag, blah, blah, blah. But what I'm saying is that people strategically in less than above board behaviors will often use somebody like that. Even watching people.
Not real hard to make someone do what they want to do.
Well, and that's the other thing.
Clear the path.
If you clear the path and you find the right guy, right? I mean, listen, if you and I are running an illegal business and we got a competitor down the street, right? Well, if we're real, real nice to a guy who hates that competitor over there and, you know, they're thinking I should go shoot up their joint, well, there's no reason why we couldn't make it real easy for that guy to get a gun and make it so that we're like the heroes among the competitors there, right? And hey, you know what? If somebody ever did take that place out, we could take care of people even better over here with our illegal business or whatever. This gets done. You know what I'm saying? Or you get somebody who owes you money but also has a grudge. Hey, listen, I got a perfect way for you to wipe your debt free. People do this. You know, they weaponize us.
And do the community a favor. It's what we all want. You'll be the hero.
See, that's the other thing, is that you take somebody who's effectively a loser, and you say, listen, you want to be a winner? I got a way for you to win. And that's what governments do a lot of times. We've got a way for you to make a mark here, to change things. You don't like this. Your family's been hurt. You've been hurt. There's a way back. And they do this with suicide bombers. They do this with various types of asymmetrical warfare situations. You just set somebody loose. And if you set 10 of them loose and only two of them land, mission accomplished, right? So...
Yeah, and I've never asked you this. I'm just curious, who do you suspect killed Officer Tippit?
Who do I suspect killed Officer Tippit? Well, I actually side with the idea that it may be a jealous husband that took him out. there, I've never said that anywhere before, but I think that's what happened. Not going to say which one. But I will say there are a couple of suspects that could fit that profile. And Tippit was a bit of a tomcat. So that's what I think happened there. Okay. That's about as complete an answer as I think I can give you without really digging on it. Going to say that I don't feel confident that I'm a total expert on it to explain it step by step. But that is where I'm coming from on it. Especially with the weird way he was moving around, the phone calls that he had taken or made, depending on who you're talking to, and some of the other incidents there where there was a few people around town that were a little bit pissed at JD.
What about, this is amazing, like that Sergeant Croy. He says, well, I was driving around that day because I was meeting up with my wife because we was getting a divorce. Mm-hmm. I was like, oh, okay. So you were one of the few guys off from work because you were divorcing your wife. Okay.
Yep.
Meanwhile, old Oswald's in the theater sitting next to a pregnant woman at war as hell. The two in there, is this common for women in the 60s to go watch films, pregnant women to go watch, War as Hell.
Well, two things I want to mention to you here. Be very careful because you might give Judy Baker ideas. She'll be there, she'll have been the pregnant woman sitting next to Oswald.
Oh, my God, I didn't think of that. I was putting a pillow. I used a pillow to make it look like I was pregnant.
Well, for a while there, she was saying she was dressing up like Marina when Marina was like... Because they would spot Oswald with a woman and somebody would track it down and figure out it was Marina. And then she'd say, oh, yeah, I was dressed as Marina sometimes. Please, don't get me started on her. But the other issue is, I dare you to try and find those films that were on the marquee that day. War as Hell, I can't find a copy of that film anywhere. Have you ever seen it?
Well, no. I can't see. There's another one, film two, that's a war film. Let's see. It's War as Hell. What was the other one playing?
Well, I know I have the picture behind me over here. It's autographed by Butch Burroughs. But frankly, I can't see it from where I'm sitting. But
Is he still amongst us, Butch Burroughs?
I do not know. I think he might have passed away. I think. But I'm not entirely certain. Long time ago that I saw Butch Burroughs. But if anybody doesn't know who that is, that's a guy who is supposedly... he was working the popcorn stand, right, at the movie theater. And is a witness to the arrest. So that's why I have him sign the picture of Oswald's arrest, which was also a curiosity because everybody swarmed on that place. There's film of it and everything. They actually filmed him, screaming as they were shoving him into the car. I don't know what he was saying exactly, but, what you mostly get is, what is it, McDonald's story now, mostly. The cop who captured Oswald.
Have you looked at those weird Polaroid-looking pictures from inside the theater someone took?
I have seen images from inside the theater when the theater was empty. That were taken that day, but I've never seen the pictures if there's anybody in them.
Oh, there's pictures of Oswald being beat up in the whole nine yards. I mean, they aren't good pictures, but what amazes me is there's coincidentally, there's this whole area that was, the evidence was damaged. They scratched out someone that was there.
Of course
they now, did. I have a crazy thought that it was crazy Jack Ruby, but.
Well, we'll probably never know, except that, we'll probably never know. I've never seen those Polaroids, so I can't comment on them, but I'd like to. So if you can find them or you have a copy, by all means, pass it along to me. Like to see it. Now, I've seen plenty of fake things, too. Yeah.
Of what?
Well, I've seen some fake...
What, things?
Yeah, I've seen faked images. Okay. And I've also seen images that were taken afterwards, you know, the cops standing by the seat where he was arrested and all that kind of... Like, I've seen stuff like that, and I've seen the empty theater. But also a weird question to consider here is, who the hell takes a Polaroid camera to the movies, right?
Well, I don't know as a Polaroid, but it looks like that quality.
Well, fine. Who takes a camera to the movie? You know, like, did people used to take cameras to the movies? I don't know. Many open questions, Jimmy James, but coming up is Larry Hancock, and I'm actually a little late, so I'm going to get right on to him, but I want to thank you for calling in, man.
Yep.
Anyway, stick around. The Ocelli Effect continues.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold. Silver. The stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. Perhaps you're invested deeply. Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, he knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
Ocelli.com. Do you like history? Real history that you were never taught in schools? Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia. By author Mike Swanson. With new documentation never seen before. That'll open your eyes to events that led up to this. Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia. 1945 through 1961. Get your copy today at Amazon.com. Why? The Vietnam War by author Mike Swanson.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
Ocelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
second hour of the Ocelli Effect begins now at Ocelli.com, but you could be some other time, some other place, and we do appreciate you no matter where you are, when you are, or who you are. Anyway, Thor's Day, second half of the show, and I have the great author Larry Hancock with me. Again, a guy who actually has more space, more real estate on my bookshelf than any other author. Okay, so for good reason. He writes excellent stuff. You know, Nexus is a wonderful book. If you want to try and understand the way that the national security state operates, Nexus, Surprise Attack, okay? Some of the stuff co-authored, by the way, some of it by Stu Wexler, and some titles picked out by his wife, as we've learned over the years. Unidentified. What else should we say? Shadow Warfare. A lot of books, Larry, and we did cover it in the Larry Hancock collection, so we're not going to belabor that point because we have a very interesting discussion tonight, which, I got to say, philosophically, is probably one of the more provocative things I can think of to discuss, even though it seems like hardly anybody wants to discuss it. Anyway, you'll see what I mean in a minute. Larry Hancock, first of all, how you doing tonight, sir?
I'm doing fine, Chuck. Spring is almost here, and that makes me happy.
Right, and you said you were, before we went to air, you said you were involved with some Easter egg hunts and all that. I just remembered when you said that this Sunday is Easter, right? So, I'm like...
yes, it is. You might have missed that.
Well, I always think of this time of year as, you know, it's near my birthday, because I just turned, by the way, I just turned 50 years old, Larry. So, I did that on the 7th. So, you know, that's all I think of about this time of year is my birthday, honestly. Nobody's ever called upon me to do Easter services, even though I am an ordained minister. I have done other services, but not that one. And so it is what it is. Easter is just one of those things, I don't know, I just never embraced, but, you know, other people do. Anyway, Easter is not the topic tonight, by the way, guys. How do we introduce this subject? Because this is going to be a little more wonky than some other subjects that you and I have discussed, where I've got a perfect framework for how to go about it, in my mind anyway. I don't necessarily execute it perfectly, guys, but in my mind it sounds perfect until I open my mouth. But this is a little bit more difficult. How do we begin? How do we do the 101 introduction, right? That first sheet when you crack open the book. I mean, I know book, old man, right? I know. But anyway, the first page, the first piece of the introduction here to the topic tonight, where do we start, Larry?
Well, I was thinking about that, Chuck, and it takes me back. In a lot of our talks, I think, you know, when we talk about the national security state, the military-industrial complex, deniable and covert warfare. Yeah, like we talked about in my book, In Denial, how it is that we keep doing the same thing over and over again, and then when we stop doing it, other people start doing it over, and nobody ever seems to learn from their mistakes. Nobody ever seems to learn from history, and I think, I know I whine all the time about, like, okay, does nobody ever write anything down? Do we never learn from history? Do we always make the same mistakes? And so, you know, you and I have talked about that lots, but I think there's another area that we haven't talked about, and this is what we're going to get into tonight, and the fact that we have learned a lot of things in the last century or so about human behavior, about social structures and systems and those sorts of things that are directly meaningful in terms of day-to-day things like diplomacy, relationships between nations, when do you get into a fight, when do you not get into a fight, you know, when you're going to win, when you're not, that people should have learned. I mean, there was a time in the 60s and 70s when there was a huge amount of material written that is very relevant to this that, again, nobody takes into consideration. You know, when the Russians went into Afghanistan, they didn't take it into consideration. Well, when we went into
hang on just a yeah, hang on just a second, Larry. Hang on just yeah, hang on just a second, Larry, because I want you to mute up and let your compression build up for a sec, because you're kind of crackling a little. Just mute for a second here, because this is a topic I want to make sure that Larry's heard clearly on, because I mean, literally last night, right? I'm talking about, well, how is it that we avoid war itself? How is it that we avoid the unnecessary conflict, which is always going to produce a prerequisite amount, we know, of misery for individuals who have absolutely nothing to do with the decisions that cause a conflict? And, you know, the idea that at one time people used to speak about the abolition of war, people used to speak about peace, but today, nobody speaks about peace unless there is already a conflict. And at one time, again, you know, and I hate to do this and paraphrase the many, many speeches from the 60s, which I've listened to repeatedly, but here we go. We're all on the same planet. We're all breathing the same air. We all care about our children's future. More than one leader articulated this. More than one individual tried to propagate this, tried to give people this idea that cooperation might be better than confrontation, that, you know, again, a collaboration is better than absolutely undermining a society and destroying another people because they are the presumed fabled enemy. It could be that we cooperate with each other on the planet, that we don't necessarily have to engage in these things. And incrementally, I mean, there are intellectual groups that come together and discuss this. But generally speaking, it's not part of the greater conversation that occurs until there is a conflict. Again, see, like I said, nobody speaks of peace until there is a war. And then, obviously, the people that are getting beaten want peace. Right? You know, please stop beating on me. Please stop destroying my place. Please stop destroying my culture, etc. Yes, of course they want peace. But do they want it when they're in the dominant role? And here's this weird dynamic. Is it something that is inexorable? Is it something that we cannot separate from our interactions with one another on this planet? And that's a hard question, but one not often asked. So I did just try and fill there for you, Larry, a little bit, but I think I gave you a couple of relevant points to work with. So please continue, because this is where we can, you know, if we were to learn from the history of conflict, maybe we could avoid conflict. Seems like a solid and reasonable kind of logic, but doesn't always happen that way. So, well, doesn't always happen. Never happens that way. What am I saying? Larry, go right ahead.
Yeah, and I'll try not to out-talk my stream, but, yeah. And that's where I'd like to set the context, because, as I said, we know from history, if you look at situations like Afghanistan or Iraq, or the history of two or three centuries or more tells you there's a problem if you go do certain things. And we don't, in whatever the geopolitical discussions are when those decisions are made, it seems to me like nobody ever calls historian into the room. You know, nobody, it's like, before we really commit to this operation, you know, somebody give us a briefing, not on the military aspects or the political, but give us a briefing on what's the past, what's likely to happen. Has this ever happened before? And, you know, what was that? Doesn't seem to happen. And what I'd like to get into briefly this evening is, aside from history, there was also a tremendous amount of research done in the last couple of centuries on human behavior. Behavior of societies. It's carried out in cultural anthropology, anthology, sociobiology, and people learned about what drives us, what drives humans, and what drives humans in confrontations, how does territoriality work. But it again, even though there are lots of books written, it never gets inserted into real-world dialogues. Nobody says, you know, in this context, are we likely to prevail in the short run if we go to war with these people? You know, what's going to be the result? And they never consider the fact that in terms of human behavior, the defender of an established territory can be shown to have an advantage unless you tremendously outweigh them in terms of your military might. And even then, when you do that and you occupy them, it almost never lasts in the long run.
Well, see, and here's where I'd like to... And here's where
we
I'd like
learn,
to,
but we don't learn.
Yeah, and here's where I'd like to jump in again and just let you build up a little more compression. You're okay, but let's just make sure you stay strong. And it's repeated over and over again, and it doesn't take a genius to see it. Vietnam is an example. I got to say, although I've had people object to me saying this, there's a failure to achieve victory there, regardless of what your point of view is. By the greater military might of the Americans. Okay, there was a failure to achieve victory there by the French before us. Okay, and yet that happened. Now I'll go to Afghanistan. That's real easy, right? The Soviet Union could not achieve victory, though it was seemingly the much more formidable force. Okay, and trying to fight an insurgency, as they call it often, does not have the greatest of results. Now, in Iraq, you got a very mixed results, okay? But you don't have the greater military force, which most people would say is a given, would just absolutely dominate, crush, occupy, that's it. And resistance should be destroyed directly. It doesn't work that way, it seems like, and yet this still goes on. How is it that the Russians at this point, and I don't care what your point of view is now on this at the moment for Ukraine, and I don't mean you, Larry, I'm saying that you're the listener, but here's the thing. How is it that we're on day 50? Given that it's the size of Texas and the Russian Federation should be the much more formidable, much more well-equipped, much more et cetera, no matter how many weapons you give them, it seems only logical that they should have crushed the Ukrainians by now. It never seems to work. Not the way that anybody ever envisions. Korea, okay? The conflict that didn't end, right, for a long, long time, even though there was no action. You know, there was a ceasefire for the longest time, right? We have separated countries there now. Yeah, that was not a fully achieved victory or a fully realized victory by the United States in that conflict, was it? So on and so on and so on. This is the way it is. You don't have the dominant military force which outnumbers and outguns simply going in, crushing and finishing the job. There is always a resistance. And I mean, look, nothing is 100% certain, but I mean, seems pretty consistent to me, Larry. Am I wrong about this?
No, I mean, you can take it further back in history. Look at Britain and India. Look at, you know, basically no imperial force in the 1800s, 1700s survived, no matter how dominant they were. None of those empires stayed in place. And even though they were militarily dominant, it didn't last. And I think there's a very simple equation that I think often fools people that commit to combat like this. And that is, first of all, they tend to listen to the people that are out of power in the nation in question. You know, the expatriates, the exiles, who often essentially sell them a bill of goods. Kind of like, well, nobody is really supporting the regime in power. All you've got to do is step up to the plate and every bit will switch to your side. For some reason, you know, you hear what you want to hear and they get to be very convincing. And we can see that happening over and over again. Certainly it happened in Iraq. Certainly, you know, so that's one part. The other thing is there's a very simple social equation, which without belaboring the point, it's called enmity versus enmity. Basically, any society or any government can be fragmented, but when you jump all over it, you change the equation, You know, as soon as you go to war with it and present yourself as a threat, people that were not working with each other and bad-mouthing each other, if you put them in danger, suddenly they bond together. And I think we have, that's often the other side of that equation. It's like the more brutal you are, the more they bond. And the longer the conflict is going to be, and it's going to turn into guerrilla warfare, but, which is, again, what we're seeing now in Ukraine. It's what was supposed to be a, oh, they're going to welcome us. Now you're creating a degree of enmity that will last for decades, even among those people in Ukraine who were Russian speakers who might have been sympathetic towards you. When you utterly destroy their city and kill all their relatives, it's not going to work long term. So, but again, we do that over and over again, it seems.
Right. Without fail, it seems to be the go-to when it comes time to achieve an objective. And see all this sanitized language I'm using, right? Trying to make this just a pragmatic decision. But, you know, much like we often discuss, if you learn from history, it's not so pragmatic. And as you said, look, it can make fast allies out of people that might have been arguing before. You know, I've heard people posit that if the United States were ever invaded, you might see a lot of this divisive stuff that goes on disappear instantly. And I have trouble arguing with that. How about you?
Oh, I agree. That's just, that is human behavior, you know, like it or not. And human behavior, it's not just human behavior. All societies, all biological societies behave that way. It's across the board, which is why it's so surprising when there is a body of studies and a body of literature, and you can prove this bonding effect under threat is a constant. That's why I'm always so puzzled that it like the history books, everything sits on a shelf somewhere, and when the real world decision making occurs, the funny thing is, you could have been yesterday, these same people could have been delivering speeches saying, like, you know, the threat will bring us together. You know, we will all bond together to react to threat. And the next day, they're planning to threaten somebody else. Like, don't you think that applies to them, too? It's like, nobody can ever bring it to the table in their own planning.
Well, right. I mean, one example of this, easily accessible example, is Germany. And after they suffered the punishments from World War One, okay, obviously there was resentment there and all that. What it kind of snowballs into is another aggressive campaign, as opposed to seeing that, you know, an aggressive campaign had its failures and blowback, right? I mean, now it's like, well, the only way to get out of this is to have a war. And some people do posit this in these think tanks where that is, you know, the only way out of financial difficulties. That's the only way out of other circumstances that are either oppressive or were oppressive, or you need vengeance. And whether they were the victim or not, they often go to a template that they know is destructive anyway. I mean, it's just, how many times does this have to be seen in history before somebody will blow the dust off of those books and read them, Larry?
Well, and we also have to, okay, so it's pretty clear that this applies to warfare. You know, if you want to take two or three things down, it's sort of like, you know, even if you dominate an opponent, even if you occupy the territory, that doesn't guarantee that you win, but certainly not more than the short term. So it's like one of the things you and I have often talked about, which is sort of amazing. It's like, what is the plan for after you win? You know, did you guys, okay, yeah, now you totally dominate them. What happens next? You can be pretty sure that a good part of them don't love you. You know, it's what is your plan for after the victory? And I don't think that ever goes into the planning. Certainly, you know, we can see that that didn't go in to most of the recent engagements the U.S. was involved in, like Iraq. You know, you can win and then suddenly you're on the defensive. Wait a minute, it's not supposed to work that way. So I think one aspect of it is that we learn from this is the military part can't be all that there is to it, just because of the human element of the equation. And it's a long-term thing. That's why nationalism is such a recurring factor. But the thing that crosses my mind is I can't understand why often you're talking about things that we talked about in the 60s or 70s or whatever. And there was a period of time beginning with JFK when the concept of neutrality wasn't all bad. It's like, you know, you can't be neutral. You don't have to declare sides. And neutrality works until somebody breaks it. And I think we're seeing the same thing again with Finland and Sweden and Austria and Switzerland, who made this commitment to neutrality, which can work until somebody decides to ignore the whole thing and raise the level of threat so that it's no longer a factor. I can't be neutral. And these things are really, as you said, I won't say it's common sense. It can't be common sense since we never seem to do it. But you could actually map out simple equations or whatever and like, okay, I know if I increase the threat by X amount, eventually I will force people to bond together and into defensive mode. And once I force them into defensive mode, they're no longer neutral, which is what we're seeing in Europe right now. So we're seeing the last vestiges of the neutrality that was a possibility two decades ago. And we just have to face the fact that somebody made a really bad decision and what might have been workable is now going off the table.
Well, okay, so let me ask you for context purposes, if there is a antiquated idea, because at a certain point in history, if you occupied a territory, you garrisoned it well, and then sort of took a little while to breed out, okay, some of the people that weren't sympathetic to your people, this is something that happened. I mean, Alexander the Great kind of did this. You know, the Romans certainly sort of did this, although it kind of backfired on them at a certain point where they ended up having locals setting up shop around their forts and things to their extended areas, right? And you would see that they became more like the locals than they were like the loyal Romans, and they sort of lost control of their garrisons that were put into place to sort of control the local populations. But maybe that was a successful template when things moved along a little slower and it took, you know, 10 years to approach a battlefield. I mean, is that a possibility, Larry?
It's what it is, Chuck, is just an absolutely wonderful segue for what I really wanted to make sure got into the conversation. And that there's really two types of territoriality when you're talking about this with human societies, which is what makes human societies different than other biological societies, and there are a bunch of them. And that is the fact that there are both territories in a physical sense and territories in a cultural sense. And that cultural territories make it a totally different ballgame. You can claim a physical territory and essentially, okay, say I'm dominant militarily, you know, I'm the French in Indochina, or I'm the British in India, or I'm Romans across North Africa. So I'm dominant militarily, and every time I'm threatened, I tend to win for a long time. But then what happens is this cultural territoriality, where the culture that goes along with that territory begins to assimilate you. And because you have people resident there, they get influenced by your culture, you get influenced by their culture, and in the end, their culture seems to win. Perhaps the classic example of that is the Mongols and their subjugation of China, in which the Mongols, basically committed genocide to the extent that they occupied physically and exterminated the locals and dominated. But in the end, after a couple of centuries, they looked Chinese. It's like, where'd the Mongols go? Oh, well, they're the Chinese. The Romans in North Africa were assimilated, even religiously. You know, it's like, okay, what happened to all those Roman gods? Well, now, son of a gun, what's North Africa? Largely Muslim. Mm-hmm. Assimilation occurs with this cultural territory, where physical territories carry a culture, a belief set, or whatever, which in the long run actually can absorb the invader.
Well, and that's why I often bring up Sicily, because Sicily is a primary example of creating a whole new stew of cultural identity out of the various individuals that staged invasions on that island to go to Rome. Okay. And some of it was done brutally, some of it was done sort of organically and peacefully, but here we are. Eventually, it absorbed into a unique thing that is Sicily. And what was a separate kingdom until they codified, you know, the nation of Italy at a certain point, right? But it's a fascinating thing, because that culture kept absorbing, you know, dozens of other cultures. And it did change, you know, that this is why Sicilians are so very, very superstitious, and seem to have some odd customs outside of their Christian brethren to the north, because they took on some of the spiritual / religious aspects from Africa and the Middle East and Asia, you know, and all of that kind of came in along with the assertion of the cultural influence from Rome. So when that all happened, and by the way, there's also, you know, the German influence, because at a certain point they pushed through and decided to invade Rome. We know about all this if you go through Roman history, right? But that's why Sicily's an interesting conduit, because it sort of caught it all and became this kind of uniquely distinctive thing. That's why it was a separate country, by the way, because it was unique in its territoriality and all of the cultural elements that it absorbed. I mean, would you agree or disagree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's the point, is that there are territories that have cultures associated with them that over a period of time may assimilate an invader, but also there are cultures essentially have their own territory, belief systems have their own territory, and it's amazing the extent where cultures that, you know, like religions that physically don't have to have a territory seem to come up with one. Israel being an example. You know, that is a religion, it's a culture in and of itself, which is attached to a territory. And there are other, the physical territories and the cultural territories sometimes work together, but the cultural tends to override, whether the cultural, the belief systems, the practices, the daily routines, you know, ultimately and eventually kind of overwhelm the invader, or whether they go out and seize territory for themselves. I would make the proposition that cultures actually can be effective at acquiring physical territory, whereas just military acquisition of physical territory probably fails in the long run. Cultural acquisition of territory lasts a lot longer. Mm. And probably the most obvious examples of that are the major world religions that were evangelical. And that means both Christian and Muslim were both very successful at achieving some element of cultural dominance across wide swaths of territory and maintaining it for centuries.
See, I find this fascinating because human behavior is, you know, much more influenced by a much more organic element than I think people ever give it credit for. And how do I mean this? Let me try and just give you a vague idea really fast. You can only grow certain things in certain zones on the planet. You know what I mean? Like, you can only cultivate certain things in certain places. It's much better to cultivate bananas in a particular temperate zone. It's much better to cultivate, you know, anything. Tobacco is best grown here. Coffee is best grown there. We know all this. This is part of the natural world. This is part of the natural order, so to speak, right? So why is it that we couldn't see something like this when it comes to cultural and human territoriality? I mean, it's inexorably, again, attached to the organic elements there. There's a reason why, you know, again, I talk all the time about how I'll go again to my own ethnicity. You know, Sicily, why is it they eat so much fish? Because they're on an island. I mean, it is part of the order of things that their matrix of life is seriously influenced by simply where they are on the planet. Okay? So how is it that this is not something that is taken into account where, look, certain people are going to thrive in certain places, certain things are going to thrive in certain places, and maybe it's got a lot more to do with the land than people want to give it credit for. How about that as a thought, Larry Hancock?
There is no doubt that the land, if you think about it, here's what really happens very basically. You know, where you're born, where you grow up, two things happen. First of all, and this is very similar to something we see in biology, it's called imprinting. You become generally imprinted or in sync with the physical area where you're living because you have to. You're responding to it. You're reacting to it. It's basic conditioning. You know, you learn what to avoid, what not to avoid, what's positive, what's negative. You learn not to pet poisonous reptiles. You learn not to play with, you know, carnivores, whatever. You know, if you're someplace else, you may learn not to play with street gangs. But the growing up process imprints something on you that you'll carry with for a long time. You know, it's the classic, you know, I'm a city guy, I'm a country guy, I'm whatever. You may escape it, but you carry it with you. So the physical territory, the foods, the environment, the community, the natural world imprint you into a certain culture. And of course, the other aspect of that is you're conditioned by the people and the belief systems that you grow up in. And I think everybody likes to ignore that and think, no, we are our own masters. We're not, you know, I can break out of that box. I don't have to carry anything with you. And the answer is no. After, quite frankly, we know from human learning that all of that imprinting and reinforcement and conditioning has the most impact over the first few years of your life. And that's just the way it is because it's more or less a blank slate. And you never get rid of all that. But I think the other answer to that, Chuck, is I don't think we really want to hear it because there's this view that you know, you don't have to be bound by that. I will say, you know, what we're talking about tonight and this cultural anthropology, sociobiology, what we absolutely know by provable fact about human behavior is unpleasant to many people. When back in the 60s and 70s, I can quote several books that were written, The Territorial Imperative, The Social Contract, The Imperial Animal, all giving extensive proof from biology, not just human biology and behavior, but social behavior of all types of organisms, you know, what our limitations are, what conditionings do to us, what our limitations are, things like this territoriality. And there was an immense pushback against those scientists. I mean, people, it's kind of like Darwin, his first year. There was a huge pushback saying, no, humans aren't like animals. That's terrible. You people are, you're saying that we have biological constraints and we, you know, no, we're not. We're not like animals. And basically, to some extent, that pushback neutralized a lot of these findings. So if you were to reach out now, and you would still find text in the right academic departments that contain this information, but that pushback, I think, is a lot of why, and to be perfectly honest, a lot of that pushback came from religious professionals, religious academics, who felt that this challenged their belief systems. And so,
well, see, okay, there's two things.
A lot of this is uncomfortable, and people don't want to deal with the fact that we have to operate within constraints.
Well, and there's two things at play here that I think need to be noted. One, when you talk about the religious idea, it's because most religions teach you that you're special, which is a problem when you can find a common link like this. So I can see them pushing back, but I think there's another sort of intellectual pushback that occurs here, because this couples all too well with a lot of eugenic type ideas, a lot of I'm searching for the right words here, but the people that believe that there are others, you know, people that are sort of superior for one reason or another, this couples very well with them. You're superior because your ancestors came from here. Well, you know, or you're superior because you are here. Some of that is problematic, and the idea that genetically we are preordained for certain things. This has now, in my mind, become a fallacy, because we take a look at the study of epigenetics and we realize that, you know, the old arguments, is it about the environmental, you know, is it the environment, or is it nature versus nurture, right? This kind of thing, when it turns out that it seems like both things are at play, both things are significant and equally significant. You know, you may indeed have genetic code, but if you don't do certain things to that genetic code, it doesn't blossom and continue to work in a certain way unless certain input is added to it. And then when you do add different things to it, you may have different reactions and it makes different presentations. So there's that, but there's also this idea, and again, this is more of my heart than it is of intellectual study, but I just have this belief, and I do call it a belief, okay? I don't say I know this, but I have this belief that people in general can evolve beyond, okay, all of their primal urges, all of these things that we can decouple ourselves very much from a ton of these things if we make the right effort. So I guess that's three levels of pushback I just gave on that. But I mean, think about it. These things are all, I think, valid points of discussion. Maybe not what's in my heart so much, but either way, the idea that we've seen that epigenetics, and the idea that we don't want to embrace that, you know, well, listen, if you have the right genetic code, then you are this. Predestination like that is not only an ugly thing because of the most easy thing to go to would be, what, you know, the Nazis, etc. But outside of that, I don't think it's a healthy thing to believe for a moment that everyone is preordained to something based on a genetic stew, because it turns out to be scientifically a bit difficult to tolerate. if one is starting to understand that we know very, very little about the genetic equations and are learning still about what impacts, what makes these things run and present themselves and continue to do what they do throughout the lifetime of the organism. And by the way, that doesn't just apply to us, but certainly it is significant to us since we seem to be the, you know, cognitive thinking beings, you know, air quotes on that. But you know what I'm saying? It's an interesting point of discussion. Go ahead.
And I think you've introduced the third level, which is, again, a great segue because I was going to say that. Because what we're really talking about, this is a level of social behavior way above the genetics. The genetics is just the template. You know, this is way above that. But you brought up the third major objection to this, apart from the religious, and that was that a lot of the pushback, and I'm just reading a wonderful series of essays by Freeman Dyson, who was, of course, an extremely famous physicist and scientist, but wrote in a lot of areas. And he was pushing back against it. And the interesting pushback from him was exactly what you said. It's sort of like, well, you know, I refuse to believe that we can't make ourselves better. You know, that you know, if we accept this and we accept, you know, we can improve ourselves. We're not bound by our genes. We're not bound by our physics. We're not bound by whatever. Now, the interesting thing, at the same time he was saying that, if you were in the Soviet Union, you were still seeing posters of the, quote, Soviet man, because a fundamental tenet of Marxist-Leninism was that man can improve himself. You know, if we address all of these social problems through our particular slant, we will create a new type of person who doesn't have all of these weaknesses that develop under the capitalist system or whatever. And I mean, this was still going on in the 80s, and it was a tenet of that belief that you could pull yourselves up. You just, you know, implement a new social system and you'll do away with all this badness. Okay, well, that didn't really work. So I guess my commentary on all of that would be, it's absolutely true that we're not bound by genetics. We're not bound by any of this. However, if we don't realize the parameters, the context, you know, of our social biology, the way we work with each other, the way we interact, the basic fundamental tenets of, you know, what makes a social system, what makes us human, if we don't factor that into the equation, it's kind of like you can't have a self-help program if you don't recognize your problems. You know, you if we're going to have a 12-step program, you have to divide your problems up and kind of cure them one by one. So if we're going to deal with the problems that we have in warfare and dominance and all the issues that we were talking about earlier this hour, we've got to make this list of the way we work. You know, this is just the human nature that's evolved over 4 million years. You know, and we've got to factor that in the equation. So when we lay out a plan for, you know, invading Ukraine, it's like, well, wait a minute, where's our checklist? Does this make sense? And where's our other checklist to say, if we did, what would happen? That we need some checklists to make sure that we address our, you know, our essential nature when we embark on some of these things that we do that never work.
No, absolutely true. And that's the thing. Again, the failure to learn from history, it seems to be the common thread with you and me. And the failure to learn about, you know, the reactive nature of things in general. I mean, in some cases, we've turned around, by the way, and sort of laid the blame at the feet of the environment, right? How often did we hear many years ago that the reason why Vietnam was an unwinnable situation is because our guys were not ready to fight in the jungle? right? You see other situations where they say that people, well, they weren't ready for the cold in other situations in history, right? And we talk about that as if that is a key factor, but never address this particular environmental issue, which has to
amazing that you say that. Just sometimes I love to play back what people say and go, do you realize what you just said? And it's kind of like for Vietnam. It's like, okay, the reason we're not winning is because there are jungles. So we're going to take Agent Orange and we're going to kill all the jungles and therefore we will win. What? What did you just say? And why did you ever think that was smart?
Right. That's a perfect point. And then what do you do if you want to try and terraform another place? You know, okay, they couldn't win because, well, it was difficult because of the desert. It was difficult because, all right, listen. Military troops train in all kinds of environments. It's not a valid excuse. It just is not. And then the solution to the problem is even weirder. Like you said, okay, well, let's just, you know, what was Agent Orange? It was to defoliate. What does that mean? Destroy the jungle. So if we don't have a jungle to fight in, we'll be okay.
And what's the corollary to that? Again, everybody, it's as old as I, the younger listeners may not have heard this. The famous line out of Vietnam that was, well, to save the village, we had to burn it. Like, wait a minute. Even Walter Cronkite could not buy that one. It's like, why are you burning their village? That's where they all live. Well, so that the communists can't take it over. Well, who will have it after you burn it? You know, probably them. It's like some of those statements are so nonsensical that in itself might have ended the war. Like everybody listened to that and went, what did he just say?
Well, see, that's a strange thing I see in many of these conflicts where they destroy the infrastructure. Which I get it. If you choke off the infrastructure, then people can't stand and fight too long. If they've got no water, they've got no heat in certain circumstances, or they've got no access to food, you destroy the infrastructure, you burn down the crops. I get it. But then there's what happens after. Okay, so let's just say you won this territory. It is scorched earth. What are you supposed to do with it? Rebuild it? Well, apparently people have gone into business to do that, Larry, but...
That's my second question. It's like, okay, you had a plan for winning the war. What was your plan for winning the peace? Now let's translate that into something that's going on right now so everybody can see it, and that's that the Russian practice in Ukraine is to destroy, literally down to rubble, all the cities in eastern Ukraine. And then they're going to declare that eastern Ukraine is secure and, you know, all of the separatists are going to be left with nothing but rubble. And, like, did you win the peace? You know, you won the war, but what comes afterwards? And then they're going to want you to rebuild it, which is where you just win. It's sort of like, wait a minute, I spent all my money and time and energy winning the war. I have none left for the peace. So what's going to happen afterwards? I lose.
There you go. I mean, I go to the analogy of, well, I've got, you know, mice in my house. Let me burn down the house because the mice will have nowhere to live. And, okay, that may indeed get rid of the mice, but it also gets rid of the house. So, you know, what are you taking back from the mice exactly? You know what I mean? And that's in a case of a small rodent. Okay, it's bizarre to me to think this way. We're going to stop people from robbing your house. How did you do that? I demolished it. Okay. I guess nobody
can
rob it.
They can't steal my stuff now.
They can't steal my stuff. I mean, all my stuff's in rubble, but they can't steal it now. That's good, I guess. I've never understood this, but Larry, I want to give you the last. Believe it or not, we went through a whole hour on this discussion. I don't think you got to half of what you wanted to, but... By all means, go ahead and take a few minutes and sort of close it out for us. But, I mean, this is a great thing to consider. It does boil down, in my mind, to the statement you just made about, okay, you've got a plan to win the war. Now, how do you win the peace? Which is interesting and sounds like, oh, that's one of those woo-woo kind of... But no, afterwards. You know, war is not meant to be perpetual, no matter what some people will tell you. Afterwards, what do you do? Well, I guess you bring in your good friends at Halliburton and stuff to rebuild, right? I mean, okay, I guess that's a business model, but does that serve to actually achieve victory? Victory is not merely on the battlefield, Larry. That's all I got to say about it, but you go ahead.
Well, that kind of reminds me of, we shouldn't get into nation building and because what really happens, which we've seen over the last few decades, is you bring in your companies to rebuild the infrastructure, okay, and spend tons of money. And, of course, the GAO will prove to you that a lot of it was just squandered. But in any event, so what happens after you finish that? Because there's a transition period, right? So you won the war, there's a transition period where you're rebuilding the infrastructure to support this new regime that you put in place. Let's think Afghanistan or Iraq. And then within about, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years, guess what? The results of cultural territoriality rear their ugly head. Everything that you just did, your regime is out of power. And by the way, if you were Soviet or American, it doesn't matter. Your regime is still out of power within 10 years. And all the money you spent on the infrastructure is now nationalized by a regime that's probably hostile towards you. Yeah, right. We can see these scenarios pretty well. So I guess what we really have to recognize, I think, is that at the root of all of this, you know, we often talk about learning from history, but what underlies the history is learning from the human condition and learning that humans are social animals, that are conditioned, that do have certain behaviors, not genetically necessarily, but conditioned by their growth and development, where they grew up, the culture they grew up in, that they carry with them. And one of the things that's basic to that is just them being part of a social group is territoriality, whether it's physical or virtual. And you just literally have to recognize that that plays in their history, their belief systems, their politics. And so you need to deal with it in geopolitical affairs, in interrelations, when you're making plans that involve groups that are in other territories, you really have to consider those factors. If you don't, yeah, you could have looked at the history and history could have given you a clue. But you might have even looked at a level underneath that and said, you know, wait a minute, let's look at these fundamental things and how is this going to play out? And if you do, you'll go, oh, geez, it always plays out the same way. And that's why the histories are all the same. But I don't know, Chuck. I think it's so uncomfortable. And people always think that we can overcome the human condition, whether you're building the Soviet man or where you're building the whatever. We can totally escape from the human condition. Certainly we can improve it, but we can ignore it, which is what we seem to do all of the time, and that's not good for the plan. That is the pitfall, and almost everything we do is ignoring the human condition.
No, absolutely true, and I guess ultimately I come down to one of my very common conclusions, which is pretty simple. War is definitely a racket, as Smedley Butler once said, and, you know, I do understand a little bit about rackets. They are not meant for people to achieve victory. It seems to me as though it's just a business model that you live on until the racket runs dry. And here's the problem with war as a racket, Larry Hancock. It never runs dry. You can always create another conflict somewhere else, sometime else, with another people. And all you got to do is create, yet again, another fabled enemy. So, Larry-Hancock.com, I urge you to go over there, take a look at his blog. Of course, I recommend just about every single thing he's ever written. Caveat there. No, actually, I do recommend everything that I've read of Larry Hancock's, but you know what? Maybe I missed something. you guys can let me know. Larry Hancock, my guest in this hour. In the first hour, I just took calls and mainly talked to Jimmy James. So, is what it is, and I'm glad you guys were with me. Remember this, guys. I am merely Ocelli, and all of you are indeed the effect. One more time, Larry-Hancock.com. Go there.